Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Bruner podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Rajiv Srivats, partner at Antler India and co-founder and ex-CTO at Urban Ladder. Rajiv recently joined Antler to lead their India program along with Nitin Sharma. Antler is a global early stage VC that aims to create thousands of companies globally by enabling and investing in the world's most exceptional people. Prior to joining Antler India, Rajiv co-founded Urban Ladder, one of India's top omnichannel furniture brand, and raised over $100 million in venture capital from top VCs like Kalari Capital, Safe Partners, and Steadview Capital. An alum of IIT Madras and IIM Bangalore, Rajiv has been featured multiple times in the Forbes 40 Under 40 India list. In this episode, Rajiv talks about his part to Antler India, building and scaling Urban Ladder, raising funds from Mr. Ratan Tata, the difference in fundraising approach between the 0 to 1 and the 1 to 10 stage of a startup, managing expectations of different stakeholders of a company, and overcoming valleys of death as a founder. I had a great time talking to Rajiv, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Rajiv has to share. Hey Rajiv, welcome to the VC Pruner podcast. Very excited to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me and looking forward to chatting with you.
Rajiv, most of our listeners won't need an introduction, but for a handful of those who don't know you yet, you know, it'll be good to just give them a brief background and your path leading up to Antler India.
I'm sure more than a handful don't know me. So, my path starts quite a long time back, feels like a relic in the, in the 2020s. So 21 years back, graduated out of IIT Madras, then went into Infosys. At that time, Infosys was the dream job. I'm sure a lot of people wonder how on earth Infosys can be a dream job right now if you're graduating. But 2 years, loved Infosys, loved coding, decided to go the MBA route, went to IIM Bangalore 2002 to 2004. That's where I really exploded in terms of what I thought I could do and really went the very entrepreneurial way. I built out the campus intranet, was pretty much part of every single extracurricular activity at campus, also stopped coding, which I think I regret today. Then decided that tech is still where my heart was, went to enterprise tech and Cognizant for 4 years, learned the ropes on, business analysis and some level of product management, and SaaS was not a word at that time. So it was really selling to enterprise clients. But somewhere 4 years into that, realized my heart was really in the internet world. And I had built the intranet at IMB. So I knew the internet even in 2002, right? So 2008 shifted to Yahoo and really learned the ropes on product management at Yahoo, 2008 to 2012. That's also when I came to Bangalore. And really, Yahoo was an outstanding experience. I used to handle all of Yahoo India media products. Yahoo, I created the first version of Yahoo India Education. Learned a lot on product management. Then 2012 is when we decided to start Urban Ladder. So my batchmate from IIM Bangalore, Ashish, and myself, we had been talking about doing something in the startup world for quite some time. Literally meet every weekend, in the 2008 to 12. And there's a lot of inspiration in the Indian startup world at that time. So started off Urban Ladder, then 2012 to 2019, went through the journey of a founder, all the ups and the downs and the ups and the downs of a founder. And really, when I moved out of Urban Ladder, decided that, hey, I want to do something in the Indian startup ecosystem and wanted to do something early stage, but still wanted to build. But was there something that different from being just a founder that I could do? And that's when the Antler opportunity came my way. This was just around the time of the start of lockdown, 2020, March, April. Started talking to the Antler team and then decided to take the plunge. And the last 6 months, I've just about set up operations, set up the team. Just we announced a second partner last week. So now it's all about the real work of building the startups. So yeah, looking forward to that.
Great background. And, there's a lot to unpack, especially on the entrepreneurial side with Urban Ladder. So we'll talk about that. But before that, I want to start off by talking about Antler and its India program. First of all, what led Antler to, look at India, at this point in time?
I think Antler, if you look at Antler's history, right, it's a very short history at some level. It's just a two-year-old startup, right? It's built by a lot of people who have very similar values and vision coming together in terms of making a significant impact in the early stage venture ecosystem. And with very good reason, because these are all, a bunch of very smart operators, VCs, entrepreneurs. And these folks came together in Singapore with a lot of years of experience across many different companies. They've all built companies which are 3 billion, 4 billion, very strong pedigree, and wanted to build a place which would generate, create startups, right? Now, of course, a traditional VC invests in startups. They don't create startups. Antler's mission was to say, hey, at the early stage, can we work with great people who we spot talent across people who are working professionals and get them to do startups? And in that process, also obviously invest in them and get them to scale, right? That was sort of the starting mandate, started off in Singapore. And the crazy pace of execution and ambition in India, they came, India is the 11th country, right? And after that's after 10 countries expanding in Europe and Southeast Asia and US, right? So Antler itself thinks as a startup, and India had been obviously in the radar for around 12 to 18 months. And if you look at the reason why the whole world came into the map for Antler, it was also because, of course, you know, they wanted to expand fast, but also make this impact across globally and be a global player, number one. And if you look at India, India probably has the third or the fourth biggest startup ecosystem in the world after US and China at some level, right? So obviously, India was a high priority for Antler. And they'd been, I think, looking at India from May or April 2019. And of course, I came on board June 2020. And the mandate was very simple. There is, you know, even in India, if you look at the Indian VC ecosystem in the last decade, what has happened is, of course, when we raised in Urban Ladder, we raised $1 million just around the time we started, and we called that Series A, right? Compared to 2011 and 2012, today in India, there is just so much more capital, maybe 4-5x more capital, 4-5x more VCs. But really, all of that happens in the Series A and beyond, right? People were writing you $1 million checks and beyond, right? Just in the very early phases of the startup journey, and I'll maybe, you know, when we talk a bit more on that, there are 4-5 different sub-stages even before a company gets to a seed or a Series A, right? And those 4-5 stages, there's literally no institution that plays and builds along with founders. And every year there are 3,000 to 4,000 founders who come into that phase, right? Only around 100 of them really crack a Series A or a $1 million and above kind of a funding. So there are these 3,800, 3,900 people who are sort of still figuring out the ropes, right? And Antler's mandate is to really go that early stage, make sure that the early stage problems, which in other geographies is finding co-founders, getting early talent, making sure that you vet your idea, and a bunch of others. I think, as I said, there are 4-5 different sub-stages, and Antler, because the mandate is do what's right for the geography instead of having one model across the world. In India, we have picked a specific subsection of that to go after. The US operates slightly differently. Antler, Singapore, and a bunch of other geographies operate slightly differently. So we're doing what we believe is right for India after a lot of founders conversations and surveys. But fact of life is Antler is an early stage VC. So our mandate is to make sure that we build great companies, go in really early stage, work with the founders and solve the problems along with them at that stage of what they have, and do this globally so that, you know, we are able to impact the global entrepreneurial ecosystem.
Right. Got it. And what specifically, you know, about India are you currently bullish about? What makes you think that you will be able to find the right kind of co-founders and build the right kind of startups that you're looking to build?
So when we got into India, what we did was in the last 2 months before we launched the program, December end, between November and December, we surveyed 1,100 entrepreneurs, right? And this is probably, you know, without being made so in public, this is probably the largest survey of founders in India, right? And these are founders, thanks to the network across LinkedIn and Twitter and just a lot of people who sort of retweeted and stuff. We got that number of responses. We also did around 50 plus qualitative responses to make sure that we were sort of vetting the results. If you look at founders in India and what's really ailing, right? One, what we came, you know, became clear was the biggest reason why people were not actually making the jump, right? And just to take a step back, if you divide the early stage founder ecosystem into 5 sub-stages, right? Starting with stage one, where they are still working in a company, have multiple ideas, and are yet to make that jump to be a founder, right? So let's start with that, right? That's stage one. Stage two is I have finalized, I'm going to go after one space of those 3 or 4 that I've been dabbling with, and I've started doing customer research and customer validation. Stage three is where I have done customer validation. I know the problem statement I'm going to track, and I've just started building an MVP. Stage four is I've built out an MVP. I'm just about getting traction. And stage five is where I've gotten some early product market, you know, traction, and I am really raising money. And of course, stage five, you know, beyond that is where the VCs come into the picture, right? Because you have, you know, I clearly want capital, $500,000 or $1 million or whatever else to scale. And that's stage five. If you look at Antler globally goes after stages 1 and 2 predominantly. And now in a few geographies have started going after stage 3. Antler in the US, because US is a very mature market, goes after stages 4 and 5. Now, in India, we've taken a call because we also understood where really the talent is and where the lack is. We decided to go after stages 2, 3, and 4 very specifically, right? Because we felt that at that stage, while there have been a lot of syndicates and angels and, you know, a lot of the capital part of the ecosystem, there is not one single institution that sort of helps the founder through that journey by providing them a platform to help in the build process, to provide them continuous capital, not just, you know, the big difference between, let's say, incubators and accelerators and all those that play there. They don't provide you capital for a much later stage, right? They come in with a very small amount of capital and stuff. So we also realize that capital is one of the biggest needs, right? Founders have come and said that. So we want to provide capital, you know, all the way on the lowest spectrum of 150K, all the way up to $5.5 million, $5 to $7 million through the stages for US capital. And last but not the least, the biggest ask from founders has been access to clients, access to mentors and experts very relevant to what they are working on, right? And access to a global ecosystem, right? And that's something Antler uniquely can provide because Antler is global compared to many other Indian companies. So we said, okay, be a true partner, make sure that you have seed, but capital all the way. And three, make sure that you offer global on a platter because that's where really the market is. And we have a very strong belief, you know, between Nitin and me that, and Antler as an ecosystem, that this will be the decade that India builds for the world. Now, whether that's, that doesn't mean just enterprise SaaS products, it also means consumer tech products, it also means consumer products. And there's just a lot of trend that shows that, right? I mean, you saw 2010 to 2020, a lot of China building for the world. And today, given all the geopolitical, all the talent that's coming back and just overall remote work being taking off, we believe build from India for the world is really going to have a big shot this decade. And there's no reason why Antler won't be a big part of it as long as we execute well.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree with you, you know, all of those points. You know, talking about the Antler Accelerator program itself, it's unique in a way where, you know, it's a two-phase model. Where initially you're finding your co-founder and trying to establish the team. And in the second phase, you're building the product and also, you know, simultaneously pitching for fundraising for your initial capital. So tell us about that program and, you know, why do you think that two-phase approach works better?
So finally, in India, we have tweaked the two-phase approach. Right? It is still two phases, but what we're doing is slightly different. From, again, the survey that we had with founders, what we realized was while co-founder matching and idea matching is our important parts, which is what the rest of the markets focus on, we figured that that's number three and number four in the need gap. What actually number one and number two in the needs were, one, people wanted help in just building, right? Which means a platform which can help them. Now that includes product, that includes technology, that includes design and stuff, right? So that was number one need. The number two need was, how do I take this to market, right? Which is really working closer on whether that's social, whether that's viral, whether that's client access as an enterprise customer, but really customer validation at that level of going deeper into, you know, finding out whether this is the right direction they are going after. So we also, as I explained, because we're going after stages 2, 3, and 4, and not the 1 and 2, we decided while we might help founders go help find their co-founders and vet their ideas, because we're going slightly later stage, we are not here in India helping you find the co-founder in phase one, right? But instead, what we do is, so as a result, compared to the rest of the geographies where phase one is 90 days, we have shortened the phase one to 45 days. And the stress on phase one is that we're going to get people who are already in that stages 2, 3, 4, which means they're clear of the idea. They've started building, or they've built an MVP and they have traction. We're going to have 6 weeks where we're going to be super intense, very specific to what they are doing, and go in three specific areas in depth, 2 weeks each, right? The first one is go in depth to understanding pitching and VCs and just ensuring that the business plan is actually towards building a scalable startup. Because at the end of the day, Antler's mandate is to build scalable VC-fundable startups. And that's the business we are in, right? So number one is to just understand and make sure that you've gotten your story right. Number two is going deeper into product, right? Which means that can you actually figure out as to, now that could be a specific angle on UX. It could be a specific angle on engineering. It could be to find your earliest engineering hire. It could be to build a no-code prototype based on the stage where you are. So this is sort of, we want to go super in-depth on that to make sure that you have a very defining first version of your MVP. And whichever stage you are in, even if you have a built out MVP, we want to make sure that you've done the 101s of how to do that right. So that's sort of the second part, which is the second 2 weeks, right? So that's 4 weeks. The last one is really to get you to traction and, you know, and early traction to make sure that the customer validation is happening in the right way. And, you know, as foundational and fundamental as some of these areas are, you would be surprised at the number of founders and very smart founders who do not get some of these right, right? So we want to make sure that the platform that Antler provides in that phase one takes you to be ready on that, right? So we get in 25 to 30 people, get them through this phase one. At that phase one and the end of that phase one, which is, as I said, 45 days, we then provide a funding, which we have to, you know, based on the founders, we'll decide anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000, right? So this is sort of similar to where the Antler program also globally is.
Right.
In the next 6 to 9 months, we will work far more in depth with those 10 founders, let's say we are funding, it's up to 10 founders in a program, who we will take to VC, right? Our single biggest mandate there is, can we take them to VC in a way that where they came to us at the start of the 45 days, compared to where they are after 45 days with us, compared to where they should be after 6 months, is very different, right? So we will provide an extremely curated network of experts, advisors, and mentors because of our own network here in India. We will provide on a platter access to clients, specifically global access if you're building for the world from India. And the last but not the least, we'll make sure that through this entire journey, we are building this with you. Imagine we are a temporary co-founder for you for 6 months, right?
Yep.
And a temporary co-founder in a way that if you're already strong on product and engineering, but you're not great on marketing and sales, that's the part that we'll get you the right help on. But if you are, let's say, marketing sales, but if you're not strong on product and tech, we'll get you help on that, right? So we will sort of be amorphous in a way as to get you the help that you need, which is really what's missing, right? We are not going to tell you what needs to be done. No smart founder wants anyone to tell them what needs to be done. But even the smartest of founders know that there are weak links in their armory, and really consider us as a temporary co-founder in that 6-9 months before we get you $1 million or a couple of $1 million from one of the big Series A VCs in India. So I think that's sort of at least a mandate, and it's going to be an interesting 9 months when we do all of this for the first time.
No, definitely interesting. And, you know, I'm just trying to think about Antler versus some other accelerators that have been around, some of the global accelerators, like Techstars, Entrepreneur First, Y Combinator. Clearly, there has been, like you rightly said, a big gap in getting that relevant specific advice to founders. There's a lot of advice and a lot of content on general stuff and, you know, how you should approach marketing, distribution, product. But the nuance and the specifics is something which is definitely missing. Another interesting thing is, you know, especially for early stage founders, what VCs look for is, you know, what's the ability to learn within the early stages of the startup? And I think Antler is kind of guiding them to go and, you know, cross that early and difficult learning curve. And if you're able to learn enough in that period, I think you can make a great pitch for yourself to be ready for VC funding. I think that's clearly the gap. And I think Antler is going to come and plug that.
Yeah, that's at least our aim. And let's hope we do a good job at that.
With that, Rajiv, I want to switch gears here and talk about, you know, Urban Ladder, your entrepreneurial experience. I'm sure it's been a ride of a lifetime for you. Tell us, you know, what brought you and Ashish together to change the furniture buying experience in the country? And, you know, how did you all think about the idea and came together to solve for it?
Sure. Funnily enough, the first idea was not even furniture. It was actually grocery and gourmet food, right? So this was, if I were to rewind, around approximately 9 years back, right? So I'd always wanted to do some kind of a startup, and we were brainstorming on a bunch of ideas. And this was, I think, September 2011. And we were just going on a drive in Indiranagar in Bangalore, which is, you know, for dinner one of those days, one of those Saturday evenings. And we said, okay, let's do grocery, an online grocery. I have no idea. Don't ask me why that popped up. We said, okay, you know, this is a space that needs a lot of, you know, everyday hassle, you know, calling someone to buy. And this was the time there was no Big Basket and, you know, and the rest of them were not there. But we said, okay, let's do that. And somehow I realized that while it was a big market, it was certainly not something that we were very passionate about, right? And while there was a need, on the count of passion, we just failed, right? Then grocery transformed into gourmet food. Gourmet, the problem was we were passionate about doing something like, you know, bring the ingredients together and, you know, do your own cooking and stuff. But the market size was very small, right? So then we went from one idea to another over the course of the next 2-3 months. You know, something or the other would not work out. Either I would not be passionate, or he would not be passionate, or the market size would be very small. both of us had media background, right? I was doing Yahoo Media and he also Amar Chitra Katha. So we talked about doing something in digital media. Didn't work out. Then he talked about energy. I talked about education. I loved education as a space, but nothing, you know, really stood out. And then we said, okay, let's do something for the woman as the customer, right? And that's when we also met Vani Kola, right? The first time, right? Who became our first investor. So then we brainstormed a bunch of things and Vani was like, okay, be more specific on which category, right? Then we said, okay, maybe we start with accessories and apparel. And Vani was already an investor in Myntra and said, hey, you know, Myntra is doing a fabulous job. Unless you have a very differential angle, you know, don't go into that. Then we said, okay, let's do something in home, right? With the women as the sort of the target customer. That's when sort of the genesis of the home as the, you know, direction started. And funnily enough, around a year before, we had sort of bought homes in Bangalore and we had tried to furnish this. And just jokingly, we had said during that entire process, let's do something, let's sell furniture online, because Ashish had a massive set of issues in buying furniture. I had also seen the pain that he had gone through, and I had furnished my entire house abroad. For a year, I had lived abroad, and that process was so much different compared to furnishing. So we had sort of said that in 2010, March to June of 2010, but sort of said, who are we fooling? Who on earth will buy furniture online and stuff like that, right? So we had sort of dismissed the idea in exactly 1 week in 2010. And so 2011, when we were at the fag end of, okay, we had to do something, we didn't have a great idea. We kept coming back to, okay, something home. And within home, we said, okay, if you have to solve for home, let's not take an easy category just because it's online ready. Let's solve the one which has the maximum gap, right? And that's when we sort of revisited our own problem statement from 2010. And we also talked to a lot of people. I think we talked to around 100 customers, right? Saying, okay, this is a space. The furniture is where the biggest challenge is. It's a very simple problem statement. There is just no place to buy good quality furniture with good service in a price point which is reasonable. Simple as that, right? I mean, good quality also implies design plus quality, not just quality. So we did a lot of research. So this was around November, December. We were very clear we wanted to do something. We said, okay. And then we sort of, I think, had, by that time, we had two or three conversations with Vani. And this was the time when, of course, the VC ecosystem was far less mature and stuff. And I think by December end, we were clear, okay, it was going to be furniture. It was going to be, the name Urban Ladder happened in like two days of brainstorming. I think what clinched was, you know, we both of us liked one word each on the urban and the ladder. Yeah. And somewhere that stuck, and Urban Ladder was also a domain that was available for $499 and was available on Facebook and Twitter. I think that's what sealed it for us. So from Jan 1st, we said, okay, it's going to be furniture, Urban Ladder, let's resign. Spent the next 6-7 months, understood. And our initial hypothesis of, wow, we're going to build an online site and, you know, we'll get people who already manufacture furniture, let them come put their products. We'll use third-party logistics and then, you know, we'll supply. All of the assumptions got completely thrashed in the first 6-7 months before we launched. We figured that this was 10x, 100x the problem that we thought it was. And everything from supply to design to logistics to everything was broken. So we could not just build an online website where people will come and buy. We had to literally, you know, say we had to solve for every single part of that supply chain. And even just selling it online. At that time, we knew obviously furniture was a zero market size. So if you look at data to actually start off business, there was no data that said, you know, every data pointed to that we were being stupid. But we sort of somewhere said that, hey, every category has moved online from mobile phones to books to, you know, apparel. And even 4 years before 2008, I don't think anyone in India was going to buy some of these categories online. So we said, there we took a category call and, you know, somewhere the market movement call to say, hey, that's okay that it's zero right now, but let's give it a shot. Couple of years. If it doesn't, you know, it doesn't move. We had a bank balance for 2 years, so we can always get a job back. And yeah, and from then on is when it started.
Very, very interesting. And funnily enough, you know, it starts with the domain name and getting the domain name first and everything else starts moving after that. But, you know, on a serious note, you mentioned about, you know, taking that decision and trying out things and experimenting before, you know, starting off with the marketplace and then deciding to hold the inventory. So walk us through that early days, first time entrepreneurs, no background in e-commerce or furniture. What were the key challenges, you know, that you faced in that 0-1 journey? And how are you experimenting and deciding, you know, if now is the right time to, you know, switch gears or try out something else?
I think everything is a challenge at that stage, right? Everything, your photocopy boy to the talent seller, to the investor seller, to the customer seller, to everything, right? So I think if I were to sort of bucketize the big challenges, right? One, funnily, we, you know, while investors, of course, there were a lot of rejections. We raised money, 1 million, before even we started, because we needed it, you know, making sure that the suppliers got money at the right time. And at that time, we were structured as a B2B, B2C model. So we obviously needed money to even start off, right? Thankfully, the investor part of it was less tougher than we anticipated. Of course, it was tough, but less tougher. I would say the number one was convincing suppliers to even list their products. Because at the first year, we didn't design our own products. We just curated a lot. And suppliers obviously needed some kind of advance, some kind of, you know, surety as to who on earth are you two, you know, coming to Jodhpur and here you have absolutely no credibility. Why on earth should I even supply to you products and give me 100% of the money? And a lot of suppliers would not even entertain the conversations. I think Ashish, you know, just went tremendous full hog. He pinged some 150, 200 people on LinkedIn. I was still at Yahoo at that time and he got one response, right? I think overall, it's a lot of thrashing of all the credibility and all the entitlement and all the stuff that you've built in your own head of senior product manager at Yahoo, chief operating officer of Amit Chitrakatha, blah, blah, blah. I think everything gets thrashed in your head because, you know, you're back to the ground, right? You're literally a no one in that ecosystem. And I think that's sort of one big challenge, especially if you have a lot of ego and a lot of accomplishments in your back, you know, IMB, IIT, blah, blah, blah. But all of that can take a nice walk because no one cares about all of that at that point in time. Of course, it might help you get a conversation, but that's pretty much it. Suppliers, getting suppliers to sign up was obviously a big challenge. The second was probably talent. And thankfully, I think we got lucky there. We got a very, very smart set of talent to believe in us. It required a lot of convincing, a lot of conversations, and made sure that we get the right kind of people. I mean, we got a lot of rejections, right? Because obviously people, by that time, we also had other people who had gotten 5x more money. So we didn't have that much money in the first 18 months, right? That a bunch of others had raised. So we had to do all of this thoughtfully. I think it was a lot of conviction and storytelling and just setting the vision for people on what we were trying to build. I mean, we were trying to build a brand where there was the concept of D2C didn't exist at that time. Right? Today, D2C, direct to consumer, we were one of the first in a category where D2C was not even a known thing, right? And somewhere, you know, there was, of course, there was a bunch in apparel that was starting to come at that time, but really there was, D2C was not even a concept. So I would say just making sure that taking some of those decisions, contrary decisions, right? We actually took a call 45 days after launching to shut down all India and just focus on three markets. We lost 30-35% of business, but that goes back to defining the values of what the kind of organization you are trying to build. And I think we were just wired in a way that we were very strong on values and mission and the kind of company and the kind of people that we wanted to go after. Today, things which I think all founders talk about, all founders realize, and I think there's a lot of literature and maturity in the ecosystem and with founders. Not so 10 years back in terms of, you know, how to build businesses and how to build companies. So I think we just, I would say, made sure that we aligned on those foundational elements very early and got that right. Of course, made a lot of mistakes also along the way. But I think those were, I would say, the bigger challenges in the early days in terms of taking some of those contra decisions, talking to suppliers and getting very smart talent to come behind us.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear a lot of persistence, you know, rolling up your sleeves, getting on the ground. And more importantly, you know, sticking to your values and playing the long game, which, like you rightly said, you know, now we are seeing that more in the ecosystem. So, you know, definitely useful lessons there. I want to also talk about the fundraising aspect here. And you mentioned you already had competitors who had raised funds, had a head start before you. So what was the challenge there? And one interesting fact is, you know, you got Ratan Tata on board, you know, as one of the early investors. And that's a lot of validation and a lot of, you know, confidence boosting, you know, name on the cap table. So how did you manage that? You know, how did you convince Mr. Tata?
We were actually one of the first investments for Mr. Ratan Tata, right? We were number one or number two. And then, of course, he did another 40, 50 very rapidly after that. But the Ratan Tata one happened very quickly because Vani was connected well with Mr. Tata. And she was trying to obviously get her portfolio companies to talk to him. And Ashish met Mr. Tata for, I think, half an hour, 45 minutes in his office. And he was, you know, he literally confirmed right after, because also he had a lot of passion for furniture as a sector. And he actually was an architect in his younger days. So he actually had a dining table that he had designed in his office, right? So, you know, and Ashish is very strong on design and the foundations of design of furniture, right? So I think they had a great chat on that. So, you know, we were one of the first investments that way. But I think overall, we were pretty lucky with our investor story. I think we had struggles in the second round. before we raised from SAF Partners. But I think between SAF Partners, TedView, and Sequoia, during those 18 months where we raised quite a lot of capital, we, I think, had a lot of traction and a lot of positive swing in our way, right? Everything from our customer service scores to the kind of products we are putting, to the kind of brand we were building, to the tone, to the talent, to the technology stuff we were doing. I think we had a very strong story in the way we were building out. And that, I think, helped us for sure during that journey, right? To be a very strong pull factor from investors. We never use an investment banker or any such, even for, you know, any of those rounds. So I think the story flew well, and all of them were actually customers first, right? All these investors were customers first. It's easier if you're building a, you know, B2C brand. So you have a good experience, you have a good experience, you have a bad experience, then is where the problem comes. But I think we did a pretty fair job and on pretty much all of those fronts. And I think that contributed to us, I would say, raising money.
Right. And how would you, you know, approach the 0-1 or rather 1-10 fundraising versus the 10-100 fundraising? Because that's something which, you know, founders struggle with in terms of what kind of investors and, you know, what kind of traction they should be, you know, ready with before approaching those different set of investors. So how do you, you know, think about those two separately and the approach in those two segments?
It's a very interesting question. Now that you ask it a very specific way, now I'm also wondering, how did we think about that, right? But I think 0-1 is obviously when you have early product market fit and you are sort of looking for someone who is very aligned with your vision, right? Because at the 0-1 phase, you still don't know fully well as to what you're actually building, right? So you need someone who is super aligned with your way of thinking and with your vision more than business numbers, right? Because business numbers, really, I mean, there's nothing to show at that point in time, right? It's the first one or two rounds, even at a VC level, it is really the founder and the early team and the conviction, the kind of company you're building, right? And of course, the market. So that's one thing I would say in that 0-1 and 1-10 phase. You need partners who believe in the longer term and what you're trying to build and why you're building that. In the 10-100 phase, that changes a bit more to either the kind of scale you want to achieve or the kind of growth you want to achieve or the kind of numbers that you want to go after, right? Because that's when you start looking at, okay, this is a numbers X today. Can you do a 4X next year? Because those conversations become stronger the more data you have, as well as the more scale you achieve. And of course, there are the conversations on, okay, you have one or two areas in which you have found product market fit. So now, how big can you scale those? And where do you need new investments to try? Is it a market expansion? Is it a customer category expansion? Is it a product category expansion? So those conversations are more analytical by nature, more market understanding by nature, and more extrapolation and data by nature, right? So I would say that's the, at the very core, that's the difference of the kind of investors that you're going after. Doesn't mean that the later stage investors don't need to buy into the founder and the vision, but it's just the kind of conversations I think are different, right? And then it's about belief in that, can you get that scale with a similar customer acquisition cost? Or, hey, fine, you're saying 4X, but to get to 4X, you're going to have 100X more CAC. So I think those are the kind of conversations that happen at those later stages. And of course, at the, you know, much later stages after that is about, okay, you know, what's your plan in terms of, you know, are you looking for an IPO? Are you looking for international expansion? Are you looking for an M&A? So when you get to growth capital or PE capital, that's a different kind of a conversation, you know. And of course, Urban Ladder never reached that stage, but I think that's at least the kind of conversations in terms of, you know, what I would call maybe a 100 to 1,000 or 1,000 to 10,000 stage.
Yeah, no, I think that's very nicely laid out. And one important factor that came out of all these three different buckets is the outcome that, you know, investors are looking for. Because of course, the founders are there in it for the long term and they, you know, never want to sell or never want to, you know, give up their equity. But the investors, they have a mandate and what they're looking for is an outcome. And there's a balance that, you know, the founder has to make when you have VCs on board who are, you know, kind of trying to influence the pace at which you're growing or the direction where you're going. So how are you managing that when you were scaling up? And it's a very tough challenge to, you know, keep your investors happy, but at the same time, truly do what you believe is the right direction and the right way to scale the company.
I think investors are enablers. Investors have their own clear, now that I have gone to the other side of the mandate, I obviously point is to bring some level of balance to make sure that you're founder first while you're, you know, investor as your core professional role. But investors also have a particular timeline in which they have to return their money from LPs. And they also have a particular promise on returns to the LPs, right? That's the only way they can keep raising the next set of funds. So obviously, while there is a direct contrast at some level on, you know, the outcomes for the two entities involved here. But the more aligned they are in terms of growth, and that's why at the end of the day, startups are all about growth. As long as you're growing, okay, the unfortunate reality, or if you're not growing continuously, you're going to have a problem. Investors will also have a problem. So I think the alignment has to happen there because investors have a 7 to 10 year period in which they have to return the capital, right, from the people that they got the capital from. So it's nothing is free. So that alignment has to happen. And at every point in time, one of the biggest jobs of the CEO really is to be able to make sure that the different investors who are part of the company, each investor has a different mandate, has a different style, has a different period in which they have to give returns. And you'll have to make sure that you are taking care of that. They are no different from any other stakeholder, right? So you might have grand plans to build this for 20 years. Then you have to get the right kind of investor, right? You have to sort of give exits to the early investor who needs to return their money at NX in terms of their, you know, multiple. So I think it's about making sure that you get the right investors and give exits to the earlier investors at the right points in time. And also at the end of the day, investors don't want to really intervene. I mean, investors want to be at the beck and call of CEOs in terms of what the CEOs want of them. Investors don't want to tell companies what needs to be done, right? And unfortunately, investors' time goes into companies which are not doing well, which is where a lot of the drag happens. But investors don't really want to spend that time also because they know that that company is going to be the toughest to return the money, right? But at the same time, investors can only make, especially VCs, can only make their investment if they know that this can become a unicorn some point in time, right? Because every company needs to have the theoretical chance of becoming a unicorn. Otherwise, they won't even make that investment.
Yep.
So that's sort of that very dichotomous thing that investors also have to balance. So I think it's a lot about communication, making sure that there's alignment in terms of just, you know, timelines and return expectations and all of that stuff. So it's a lot of conversations and making sure that they are considered as any other stakeholder. But at the end of the day, the CEO needs to do what is right for the company, what's right for the business. Sometimes it may not align with the investors. As long as it aligns with the primary party, which is customers, and then the company itself as an entity, it might not even align with the employees sometimes. And I mean, you'll have to do a layoff. You'll have to do a layoff. You don't have a choice. But this is a funny part about any CEO's role. At the end of the day, that entity called the company is more important than the CEO's own job, is more important than the investor's money, is more important than an employee's job, is more important than even a customer at, you know, at a, some point in time, right? The entity has to stand. And of course, there's a gradation. When times are flying well, everyone is important and everyone gets their due. When times are not, one by one, there is a cut that's going to happen to someone or the other in those stakeholders, right? And the great CEO manages that really well to make sure that all of the stakeholders get their due returns. And that's the best companies that emerge. And the thing that you want to avoid is actually being not customer focused, because that's the start of the doomsday for all the other stakeholders to start getting hit. So anyway, this is a long topic that I can talk for hours on end, but
Absolutely. And you know, that was actually my next question, which is, you know, when times are going fine, you know, you've managed to scale, you have money in the bank, you have runway, it's relatively easier, you know, to manage all the different stakeholders that we talked about. But what would be your advice, you know, when it comes to a COVID-like situation, right? You're looking at a very limited runway. You have to decide between different stakeholders, scaling back businesses, managing layoffs. And you also went through that phase. So tell us, what were your learnings and how should founders approach that dynamic when it arises?
Take deep cuts, take big, bold calls, because I think that's the one, you know, learning. You know, we have done this multiple times at Urban Ladder, right? And there is no right template to all this, right? Do it with respect. I think the Airbnb example was, I think, the best one during COVID. And I think just use that as a role model. Just be absolutely extra thoughtful in communicating. Prepare for the worst scenario. Take the deep cut one time. Don't keep doing it. You know, you think the situation is going to improve. In those moments, it's better to be super pessimistic than being stupidly optimistic, only because the more you're going to prolong some of that, the more you'll have to do the number of times, right? Take one deep cut. Take that strong call, make sure that you have it with conviction and take that call for the next 2 years. If you're going to be shooting for profitability, take that call, but don't drag the decision for 12 months. In those 12 months, you've lost more money. You've had a lot of communication, which is not clear. Investors are wondering as to what on earth you're doing. So I think just taking, and you know, this is where I think CEOs need a lot of help, a lot of coaching. I think what's happened is, of course, we have a lot of people in that 18, 19 time period. And I see, by the way, credit to all the founders who have emerged in the last 4 years. There's just a lot more maturity in the ecosystem compared to us, right? So I can sense it. I can see it firsthand. And I think it's going to take a lot of mental effort to go take some of those calls. But I think today the ecosystem is very different compared to 4 years back when we went through a bunch of this, 3-4 years back. So I would say just make sure that you take some of those bold calls and stay that course for a while. Don't keep alternating strategies, because what happens is you can't just completely foundationally change the engines, right? Suddenly you're going for growth. You need more people. Then, you know, COVID happens. You're going to cut off 50%. There's loss of credibility on what you're building. So make sure that you are at some level consistent to what you're doing. But at the same time, of course, you know, when there are blitz scaling phases, go for it. When there are blitz efficiency phases, go for it. But go for it deep enough to make sure that foundationally you're doing the right things.
And, you know, Rajiv, who was your sounding board throughout that, you know, tough period? Because there's always this thinking that the founder has to do, whether to go with, you know, his decision or whether to, you know, validate that decision through someone. So did you have a sounding board as a founding team, or was it completely, you know, your internal call?
Yeah, so this is a good question. I think even for co-founders, even if you're not the CEO, I think it's important to have your own sounding board. I didn't have one. That was a mistake in hindsight. But I think all founders need their own sounding board. I think you need one as a leadership team. You need one as an individual professional. And these are areas where the ecosystem needs a lot more maturity, right? And hopefully in the next decade, this is one area where I, you know, personally feel there's just a lot of work to be done. And in addition to, of course, the Antler mandate of doing it for the Antler founders, I think there's just a lot that can be done. And I've been sort of talking to founders who are all in the A, B, C stages over the last specifically few months of doing Antler, and even otherwise just from a pure networking perspective, seems like there's just a ton of work that can be done on this space.
Absolutely. And, you know, with founders like yourself who've gone through that experience, you know, coming out and telling those stories, I think that is going to go a long way. And, you know, people knowing about how to approach the situation itself. So Rajiv, you know, how has being an entrepreneur influenced your personality over the last decade? Because, you know, you were working with a corporate before that, you know, in a slightly safer environment versus being in a sudden death situation over the last decade. So how has that impacted your personality?
I think three very specific areas where I think I moved from 2 out of 10 to probably a 7-8 out of 10. First one, self-awareness. Entrepreneurial experiences get you really to the ground and make you look super hard at yourself, because I think you get feedback from every single angle. And funnily, that self-awareness for a bunch of founders is great, because it sort of takes you a few steps back on your own strengths, what you're good at, what you're not. A bunch of founders can take that self-awareness but not accept it, and sort of can, you know, go worse off, right? But self-awareness is something that all founders will get in ample doses. It's just the way you take it and what you do with it is the big part that is unpredictable. So for me, thankfully, I think I have come out on the better side of that in terms of using that self-awareness on every aspect of life. Two is sort of a sub-point, but really a different point, is handling failures. I mean, for all our pedigree, for all the capital we have raised, we've gone through far more failures, right? And the way you handle failure, not just professional, personal also, I think it just makes you far stronger as a person, far more aware that all the highs will have some lows and all the lows will have some highs, right? So you just become far better at handling it. And I think just the concept of failure in India, irrespective of what your background, is just not discussed enough. And that's a part that I stress a lot on whenever I talk to younger entrepreneurs. I stress a lot on this aspect on how to handle. And it's very individual still, but at the same time, be ready that you have to handle it and figure out your own way in which you're going to handle. The third is, I think I became far more confident, far more outgoing, and far more a people person. That I've never handled HR before. In Urban Ladder, I had two very specific big mandates. One was product technology and one was HR. Third in the first 2-3 years was marketing and brand. But on the people front, I mean, one of the founders has to be 50%, if not more, people. Everything that a founder does is people, you know, and that's everything from org structure, KPI setting, to engagement, to performance management, to potential development. I think that also makes you not just more people-centric and people-aware, not just more foundationally, what are the drivers to get people to really scale up and grow in their careers, but also I became far more outgoing in terms of being even able to talk like this and or being able to address a set of 1,000 people, like, you know, on topics to motivate and to announce layoffs. I mean, you know, you're suddenly doing stuff that you didn't build a company to do layoffs, but you're sort of put right out there. So I think just far more outgoing, far more people-centric is something, which is a third aspect. But yeah, it's a huge sea change over 10 years.
Awesome, awesome, Rajiv. I think there's a lot of founders who are listening to this. A lot of them who are on the fence are going to jump into this and, you know, just think about the kind of growth that you can experience by putting yourself in uncomfortable positions, a position that you may not, you know, envisage yourself being in. So with that, Rajiv, you know, let's jump into our final segment, which is the rapid fire. I'll ask a few questions and hope to get your immediate thoughts on the same.
Sure.
One thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem?
Just make sure that we have a far stronger ability to attract early stage talent, okay? Because I think that's one area where founders struggle a lot. So early stage talent, smart engineers, smart designers, smart product, people to make that jump and really try early stage startups. I think that's one thing that I would change.
If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose?
Living life or handling failures? I think one of these two topics.
What's your definition of success, Rajiv?
My definition of success is actually, funnily, don't focus on success. I think focus on experiences. It's, you know, there's this famous quote, right? Is it about the destination or is it about the journey? Funnily, it's actually about the people that you're doing all this with, right? And success for me is being in flow. If you're in flow at that particular moment, which essentially means you're doing this with someone that you want to be doing this with, and you're working on something that you love doing, that is success, because outcomes are absolutely unpredictable. So success is just being in the flow. And I would say elaborate, expand it to professional and personal.
So Rajiv, before we sign off, any last thoughts for aspiring and current founders who are listening to this?
I would say just make the jump, irrespective of whether you're at college, whether you are at whatever phase of life. Make sure that you have maybe 12 to 18, 24 months of cash in bank, because you're not worried about that. Do it with people that you admire. It doesn't have to be people that you know for life. It is people that, you know, you respect for their specific skill. Make sure that you're building something which lasts the test of time. Do it purely for the impact that it's going to have for customers, not for the money, not for the fame, not for the romance of it. But if you feel that you can actually go after that problem for the next decade, through all the pains with the people that you respect and build something meaningful, I think just go do it. There is absolutely no risk for smart people today in this ecosystem. That's pretty much my only two cents. Not advice, but more a call for smart people to get on board.
Awesome, Rajiv. This has been, you know, one amazing conversation. And thank you so much for taking our time for this. I'm sure our listeners are going to learn a lot from this conversation. So thank you so much for doing this.
And thank you for having me. And it's been an absolute pleasure and good to reconnect as well as reconnect with my past at some level, talking through all of that. It's been a while since I've talked about all my entrepreneurial experience, but good to chat and hope this is of some little value to someone who's just on the fence.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruna podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guest know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.